Morning. If you missed my introduction to the first lesson, today we're talking about what you could call the seasons of life. In the first lesson, we talked about the teenage years and the special choices, challenges, and chances that apply to a person that's in their teenage years. In this lesson, we're talking about a much larger cross-section of life. In this lesson, we're talking about people who are in their college years, also people who are newlywed, and pretty much anybody in their 20s and 30s. So this applies to several of us in here today. Moving out of the house can be a hard experience, but it can be a great experience too. I know not everyone has a great experience, but for the most part, I did have a good experience when I moved out of the house and went off to college on my own. Obviously, there were temptations and struggles, and I made some pretty catastrophic mistakes, like a lot of people do. But as a whole, I would say I had a pretty good experience. I graduated from Missouri State University about 15 years ago, and not too long ago, my niece Sarah started attending there. I guess it was like 4 years ago now, but she started attending there, and she invited me onto the campus to lead a Bible study. And coming back to that campus after so long away from it hit me in a way that I was not expecting. Because walking the sidewalks of that university in the cool of a fall evening when I was 30-something years old gave me the exact same feeling I had when I was 18 years old. You know what that feeling was? It was the feeling of freedom. That was the thought that was ringing through my mind. Because that's exactly what it felt like when I was 18 years old. Because it was on that campus that I got to be exactly who I wanted to be, for better or for worse. That's where it all started. I got to make my own choices without my parents' approval. I could do whatever I wanted to do, whenever I wanted to do it, and so I did. As a young person in college or of college age, outside of your parents' home, you are free to make choices that you've never made before. And that's what we want to talk about first, is the special choices a person has to make when they're in their late teens, going into college, in their 20s, and even into your 30s. You are free to make choices that you've never made before. And that's the beauty and the danger of this phase of life. This is exactly what Solomon was talking about in Ecclesiastes 11, verses 9 and 10. Solomon said, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes." He's kind of being sarcastic because he says next, "But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity." The college years, the late teens, going into the 20s, are a particularly treacherous phase of life, maybe more so than any other phase of life. And it's because of these freedoms and these choices. You get what you always wanted, and that is unsupervised liberty. Isn't that pretty much what every teenager wants? Isn't that what every kid wants while they're still in their parents' home? They want unsupervised liberty. And that's exactly what you get when you move out and you go off to college, or if you don't go off to college and you're just out on your own in your 20s. You get to make your own decisions, but you also lack the foresight to see the consequences of those decisions. But you don't know that you lack the foresight to realize the consequences of those decisions. There are so many important decisions to make and so little experience to inform those decisions. As Rick Sparks says, you can't put a wise head on young shoulders. There's just no way to do it. There are certain things in life that you can only learn by way of experience. There's certain kinds of wisdom in life that you can only gain by way of experience. It's these early years in life, in your late teens, your 20s, even in your 30s, where your convictions are going to be tested relentlessly. Your faith in Christ is either going to crystallize or it's going to be destroyed. Because it's in these early years of adulthood when you are forced to choose what you actually value the most. You are forced to choose who you love the most and what you want the most. You have no choice but to make a choice. It's in these early years of adulthood that you have to decide to go to church. And why is that? Because your parents aren't around to make you go. You have to decide that you will read your Bible and pray because your parents aren't around to do it for you or with you. You have to decide personally to stay away from temptation and sin for the same reason. Because your parents, who have been supervising you for the last 18 plus years of your life, are not around to stop you now. It is during these years that you must choose what God you will serve. You must choose to associate yourself with God's church. But there's another choice that most people make in this phase of life. It is arguably the second most important decision that anyone will ever make. And what is that? Your spouse. When you're a teenager, you have to choose to be a Christian. And when you're in your 20s or 30s, that's when most people choose their spouse. And you know, choosing a spouse is different than other choices. You know, if you don't choose to be a Christian when you're a teenager, you can fix that later. If you associate yourself with the wrong friends or the wrong church, you can fix that at any time with minimal collateral damage. But choosing a spouse is not like that, is it? Choosing a spouse is bound up in a covenant. If you choose the wrong spouse, that bad decision will follow you the rest of your life because marriage is meant to be permanent. The bond of marriage is tied up by God and only God can break it. And so, listen to me carefully on this, when marriage is broken, there is always some kind of sin involved, 100% of the time. Now, sometimes it is sin that led to the breaking of the marriage, and there's biblical reasons for the dissolution of that marriage. And sometimes it is not sin that led to the divorce, it is the divorce itself that can be the sin. But does the world care about this? Does the world think about it that way? Absolutely not. Most people in the world don't care, but God absolutely does. Nobody can casually get married. And so this is a very simple message. If you're in your late teens, your 20s, your 30s, you're not married yet, but you're going to get married, do not mess this up. You have a chance to make the right choice and choose the right spouse, and God cares about this. You must choose another Christian. You should choose someone who will make you personally a better Christian. And you must choose someone who enthusiastically supports your Christian walk. So don't compromise. This is such an important choice. You cannot compromise. You may choose to date or court someone who is unconverted or uninformed, but you do not want to marry someone until they share your faith in Christ, until they enthusiastically share your faith in Christ. I know a lot of Christians who didn't marry a devoted Christian spouse. And they would never say that they regret that. But they would also admit that their life would be a whole lot easier if their spouse was a Christian. They would tell you that. They wouldn't say they regret it, but they would tell you their life would be a whole lot better if their spouse was a Christian. So let me give you a little advice on choosing the right spouse. This is going to sound a little counterintuitive, but I think you'll understand what I'm saying. First off, don't marry somebody that loves you. Marrying somebody that loves you is the worst reason to marry somebody. You can go find anybody who'll love you. So do not marry someone who loves you. Marry someone who loves God. Do you see how that's a totally different approach to finding a spouse? Don't marry someone that loves you. Marry someone who loves God. And if they love God, they'll love you even more than they would have otherwise. Here's another reason not to get married. Do not marry someone who wants to make you happy. That, again, is a terrible criteria for choosing a spouse. Do not marry someone who wants to make you happy. Marry someone who wants to make God happy. Marry somebody who wants to make Jesus Christ happy. And if that's their goal, they will make you much happier than if their chief goal was just to make you happy. Do not marry someone, kind of along the same lines, do not marry someone who is going to make you first in their life. That is not the person you want. If that person is set on making you first in their life, you are set up for a miserable marriage. Marry someone who has made Jesus Christ first in their life. And if they have done that, they will make you significantly happier. Marrying someone for emotional reasons is a really terrible reason to get married. Marriage is a job. No matter how much emotion you have invested in it, no matter how much you love somebody, no matter how much they love you, love itself is not the only thing that keeps the marriage going. Marriage is a job. There's work to do. So the best advice I can give you is find somebody who will get the job done with you. So outside of choosing a faithful spouse who will get the job done, there are obviously some other very important decisions to make during this phase of life. Again, we're talking about late teens, going into college, newly married, talking about 20s and 30s. So other decisions that you have to make during this phase is, will you go to college? Will you not go to college? If you go to college, where will you go to college? What kind of work do you want to do? Where do you want to live? Where will you go to church? And then once you get married, you start all over on all of those decisions. You've got even more decisions to make as well. Once you get married, you have to decide how you're going to apply biblical principles of marriage to your personal marriage. You have to decide when you want to have children, if you can have children. You have to decide how you will raise these children. This is why Peter Pan didn't want to grow up. You know, everybody, when they're a kid, they look forward to making all these decisions, and then you realize how hard it is to make all of these decisions. If we had more time, we would treat newly married as its own phase of life. Because being newlywed is fun, just like every phase of life, but it's also hard, like every phase of life. Because when you're newly married, you just spent the last 4 or 5 years of your life enjoying freedom, autonomy, making your own decisions, doing whatever you want to, whenever you want to do it. And then you get married, and it's great, but somebody else in the house gets a vote. And that's not the way it was for the last 4 or 5 years. Somebody else has a say on what you do and when you do it. There's a new set of opinions and emotions in your house. There's new conflict in your house that you never had to deal with before. I grew up in a house of 4 boys, and it took me a long time as a newlywed to realize that you cannot talk to your wife the same way you talked to your brothers growing up. That's a terrible thing to admit, but that's true. I didn't know. I didn't know the way that you speak to a girl, to a woman, is not the way you speak to your brothers, right? When you talk to your brothers, you just say exactly what you want to say. You say whatever emotion you're feeling, you get it over with, and then, like, everybody's fine later. I didn't know that that's not how marriage works. And I'm not telling you I've got it all figured out, because I definitely don't have it all figured out. Joanna would verify that for you. I've been married for 13 years, and I came across some advice recently I'm going to give a try. The famous fisherman Bill Dance said, if your wife is mad at you, buy a new fishing pole. She'll still be mad at you, but you'll have a new fishing pole. I'll let you know how it goes. Nate's heard me give this lesson before, and one time Joanna and I were having a little disagreement, and he goes, Dad, you better buy a new fishing pole. And then later he told me, Dad, you'd have a lot of fishing poles if you actually did that. So those are some of the choices that a person makes in this phase of life. There's the big one, the giant one, what spouse you choose, and then all the choices you end up making after that. I also want to talk about challenges. Those choices are sort of their own challenges. And if those choices weren't hard enough, in this season of life, again, going into college, newly married, 20s and 30s, this season of life also presents a new set of challenges. For many college-age Christians, The biggest challenge is college itself. And I am not talking about passing all your classes. What I'm talking about is surviving 4 years of the college system and coming out on the other side as a faithful Christian. Colleges and universities are not neutral ground. They're just not, and we need to know that. As parents sending our kids off to college, and if you're a teenager going into college, you need to know this, that the spirit of colleges and universities is not in line with the Christian spirit. Now, let me be very clear about something. I am not against college. So I'm not saying don't go to college. I teach at two colleges right now. So I'm definitely not against college. But we still need to acknowledge the obvious that the university atmosphere is having a devastating effect on young Christians. There's just no debate about that. In 2008, which was a while ago, I'm sure it's much worse now, but in 2008, UCLA published a study trying to define how college affects students' so-called spirituality. So these professors that organized and facilitated this study, that's what they felt like they were measuring, spirituality. And this information was an enormous study. It was collected on 14,000 students from over 140 different schools. So very wide, very comprehensive view of the effect of the university environment. So here's how the study worked. The study surveyed college freshmen and then surveyed college juniors to see how certain religious and spiritual attitudes changed in the first 2 years of college. And the results are pretty depressing, but not surprising. So again, this is from 2008. If somebody was performing this study today, they might ask a little different questions. But I picked out just a few things that I think will tell you about what's happening. So in a survey of freshmen, 44% of college freshmen regularly attended religious services. So what about college juniors? How do you think that number changed? Yeah, it went down significantly. It was almost half. So it went from 44%, and then 2 years later, by the junior year, it was down to 25%. Another question that was asked as a part of this survey, 54% of college freshmen stated that they believed gay couples should be able to legally marry. How do you think this number changed for college juniors? As you would predict, it went up. It went from 54% up to 66%. They also asked a question about abortion. 52% of freshmen stated that abortion should be legal. How do you think this changed for college juniors? Again, very predictably, that number went up by about 10%. 63% of college freshmen stated that people can grow spiritually without being religious. But this increased up to 75% for juniors. I found that question to be very interesting. This idea that there's something significantly different about being spiritual versus being religious. So the college professors that facilitated this study, how do you think they perceived these answers? Do you think they saw these things as positive or negative? They saw it as overwhelmingly positive. They saw this as the university environment is doing its job. That's the way they saw it. That this was a huge success to see people leaving church and endorsing these other views, which are very clearly against Christian thinking. And if you think about the rate at which this change is taking place, it's pretty dramatic, isn't it? I mean, how many years does a kid spend in their parents' home? 18 years at least, and then in just 2 years, their religious or spiritual thinking and their activity as far as church attendance is changing significantly. Broader studies on church attendance also agree that most young people drop out of church after high school. Church attendance is not the only way to measure faithfulness. So again, I should be clear about that. It's just a very easy way of measuring how serious a person actually is about their Christian faith. So in the context of church attendance, another study showed that 70% of young people who went to church in high school stopped going after high school. And unfortunately, this agrees with my own observations. Growing up at Murray Road, if I go back and I think about all the kids that I went to church with up in Lee Summit at Murray Road, and if you make a list of the kids that I grew up with, you know, plus or minus 5 years, and what percent of them are no longer associated with church or Christ in any way at all, it's around 50%. And if you ask around and you think about it, most congregations have a pretty similar experience. It's an anomaly to find anything better than 50%. Whenever I teach at teen studies and college studies, I tell them this. I tell the kids to look around at the people they're sitting by and just realize that in 3 or 4 years, 50% of you will be long gone. And of course, when I say that, a lot of the, what do you think the kids say? They say, oh no, that's not going to happen. There's no way. And then 4 or 5 years later, I'll have kids come back to me and they'll say, you're right. I can't believe it, but you were right. So the challenge for us is just to accept that this is how it normally goes. And if nothing changes, nothing changes. This is just the path. This is what normally happens unless we, as the church, decide to be different. So that is one of the great challenges, surviving the college environment, surviving the university environment, and all the freedoms that come with it, and still being a Christian at the end. Another enormous challenge in this phase of life continues to be social pressure. We talked about the seriousness of social pressures during the teenage years. Nothing changes during the early years of adulthood. Social pressures continue to be extremely influential. This is the phase of life when your pursuits of friendships and validation can overpower your conscience and destroy your faithfulness. People will do just about anything to retain friends and to maintain approval from their friends. Sometimes we call this social dynamic peer pressure, but the real pressure is our own insecurity and our need for external validation. Why do we need the approval of our friends so badly? It's because of our own personal insecurities that we seek that out. This is a powerful force in a person's life in this phase. Somebody once said, when you're 20, you care what everyone thinks. When you're 40, you stop caring what everyone thinks. When you're 60, you realize that no one was ever thinking about you in the first place. I find that quote to be incredibly profound. I'm not far enough along in life to know for sure if it's true, but it sure sounds like it could be true. I'm not quite 40 yet, but I have reached the phase of life where I no longer care what everyone thinks. I have no problem meeting the UPS man in gym shorts and knee-high black socks and my house slippers. I would have died when I was a teenager. I mean, I would have taken a shower and got dressed before I would answer the door, right? But I don't care anymore. It's a funny thing. But one thing I can confirm that I think is definitely true about this quote that I just read you is it takes a long time, and this is the substance of this quote, it takes a long time to realize that we are not, in fact, the center of everyone else's universe. Isn't that really the idea here? We spend a long time in life thinking that the universe revolves around us. Many people in their teens, in their 20s, even in their 30s, are obsessed with themselves, and they just assume that everybody else is too, and eventually you have to stop thinking that way. Eventually, you have to stop obsessing and caring about the opinions of everyone else. And I admit, I really am just now figuring this out. And I, like I said, I'm embarrassed to admit that. I think I knew from an intellectual standpoint that I don't exist for myself. I knew that intellectually, but not in reality. Not to the extent that that understanding actually governed my thoughts and decisions. Another great difficulty and challenge of this phase of life, again, we're talking about kind of the early years of adulthood. We're talking about going into college, being newly married, 20s, even into your 30s. Another enormous challenge of this phase of life is sexual immorality. It starts as a challenge in the teenage years, and it continues to be a very, very serious struggle for people in their late teens and 20s. For everybody, but especially for people who are unmarried. Temptation results from desire and opportunity. And what do you have an abundance of in this phase of life? Your desires are never greater, and your temptations, opportunities are never more abundant than they are in this stage of life. For example, pornography. Pornography use that starts in the teenage years escalates to full-blown addictions in this phase of life. And the damage that it does to people, men in particular, and their marriages is incalculable. And again, it only gets worse after the teenage years. A lot of people start into this thing and they think that they'll just quit later. That's not how it works. That's not how any addiction works, and it's not how pornography addiction works. Let me give you a few statistics that will blow your mind if you don't know this already. 35% of all internet downloads are related to pornography. That's over one-third. Over one-third are related to pornography. Mobile searches. 20% of all mobile searches are for pornography. And then another one that should be relevant to all of us today, 64% of Christian men say they watch porn at least once a month. So it's not like, well, I'm a Christian, so I don't do this. It's not like if you're a member of the church that this just isn't a problem, isn't a temptation. We should never assume that. And these same fleshly desires often lead to just outright fornication and an overwhelming abuse of our sexual desires. There's a passage in the book of Proverbs that speaks explicitly to men, and it's obvious because men in particular struggle with these sorts of things. And I remember reading this as a young man and found it to be incredibly accurate and powerful. So I'm going to read it to you. Proverbs chapter 7, verses 21 through 27, talking about these desires that get out of control. Proverbs 7, verses 21 through 27. Solomon says, talking about the adulterous woman, with her enticing speech, she causes him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. Immediately, he went after her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow has struck his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Now, therefore, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray in her paths, for she has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. I find several parts about that passage to be extremely helpful. How does Solomon advise that you handle the temptations of this kind of woman? What's he say? He says, stay away. Stay out of the path. How are we supposed to deal with fornication or sexual immorality? You remember what Paul says a few times? What are you supposed to do? He says, flee. Flee sexual immorality. Flee fornication. I find this to be very good advice. Don't try to be tough. Don't try to be strong. Don't act like you can handle these temptations, because overwhelmingly we won't be able to. So run away from it. That's what Solomon is saying here. Don't even get close. What kind of people are destroyed by these sorts of temptation? Just the weak, just the wounded, just the fragile. What's Solomon say? The strong. Even the strongest will fall. So keep this in mind as you're dealing with these temptations. So those are some of the very difficult challenges that are associated with this phase of life. But again, it's not all bad. There are some very great opportunities for somebody who's in the early years of adulthood. This period of time between graduating school and having children is one of those sweet spots in life, because you have freedom, you have a little bit of money, and you have an enormous amount of time. When I was newly married, Wade Stanley said to me, Tad, you don't realize how much free time you have right now. I didn't believe him. I thought, wait, I'm busy. I'm busy fishing. I'm busy hunting. I'm busy. I only realized later exactly what he meant by that. Eventually, you will get busy with some very serious things in life. And it is true that this little window of life between being done with school and having children is an opportunity that you'll never have again. When you're at this phase of life, you go get ice cream at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know why? Because you can. You don't need a particular reason to do it. You just do it because you can. You go on spontaneous road trips just because you can. You don't really have to think about what you're doing tomorrow or the next week or the next week because you have so much time between now and then. So the message is very simple. When you're in this sweet spot in life, use at least some of this excess time in ministry for the Lord. You can still have fun. You can still be spontaneous. But don't totally squander all of this time on worthless pursuits. That's why Paul said in Ephesians 5, verses 15 and 16, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil." So again, use this time to do some good things. Use this time to get to know your new husband or your new wife. Use this time to develop some good Bible study habits, to be active in the church. And then finally, another enormous opportunity that you have in this phase of life is realize that enthusiastic young people have a huge influence on the church. I would say in many places, in many congregations, it's these people in this phase of life are what keeps the church going. You influence people, even people who are older and wiser. They can learn from your example. Have you ever thought about it that way? Even people who are older and wiser than you, that know more than you, can still learn from your enthusiastic service to the Lord. Timothy was a young man. He was no doubt in the phase of life that we're talking about right now. He was probably in his early 20s. And Paul said to him, Paul said to Timothy, a guy probably in his early 20s, 1 Timothy 4, verse 12, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity." That's a pretty powerful message to a young man, isn't it? Timothy may have been the youngest person in the churches that he was working with, and yet Paul calls on him, to a guy probably in his early 20s, calls on him to be the one who is an example of sound speech, of good conduct, of love, of faithfulness, of purity. And so my point is, this phase of life is not only for learning, it is also for leading. The church thrives when young adults do their part, because you've got the time and you've got the talent to move the church forward. So that's my lesson for you this morning. I appreciate your time. As I always say, I hope I gave you some valuable things to think about. This phase of life in early adulthood has a lot of joys. It has a lot of struggles. It has a lot of opportunities. But the aim of every season of life is the same, isn't it? The aim, the goal is the same. And that is to be faithful to Christ. That is the aim. The specific difficulties can change, the specific challenges change, the choices we make change, but that's the goal in every phase of life. But you can't do anything towards that goal until you've been obedient to the gospel. And that's our invitation to you as we stand and sing.